Captain Jerry Hendricks, U.S. Navy, retired as Senior Fellow and Director of the Defense Strategies and Assessments Program at the Center for a New American Security, former Director of Naval History for the United States Navy. His latest work is Avoiding Trivia, a Strategy for Sustainment and Fiscal Security. Jerry, it's a pleasure to talk to you again. Thank you for having me come and visit you in your office. It's great to see you, and congratulations on this piece. The title, Avoiding Trivia, where does that come from and what's the significance of it? Thank you very much.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to have you here. Avoiding Trivia comes out of a quote that George Kennan writes up in his memoirs about the meeting that he had with General George Marshall, who was at that time the Secretary of State under Harry S. Truman. Marshall had decided to stand up the policy planning office within the State Department and had asked Kennan to come in to head that up. Kennan at that point in time had been first on leave, and he was at the National Defense University where he had been writing, most importantly, the X article that appeared in the 47 issue of Foreign Affairs. But Marshall brings Kennan in because they're looking at a crisis in Europe, and they need to formulate what the U.S. strategy is going to be vis-a-vis both European recovery as well as how do we look at dealing with the Soviet Union. And as they began to prioritize, you know, what's going to be important and what's not, Marshall gives Kennan the one injunction, which is avoid trivia. Don't get caught up in the small stuff. Let's make sure that we prioritize, and if we're going to spend money or address issues, let's address the major issues. And I think that that's a lesson that we should be still looking at today. The other aspect of this looks at what is the strategy for the United States going forward. For most of my lifetime, the strategy was one of containment, the containment of the Soviet Union, containment of communism. And today, as I began to look at where are we in the world and as a nation and what we need to go to look at going forward, it seemed to me that we need to focus on sustainment. How do we sustain the U.S. position going forward? There's not necessarily a specific competitor that we're looking at right now. Really, our largest challenge in many ways is ourselves. So how do we sustain our position going forward? So hence the title of the paper.
Why are we potentially our greatest enemies? Not the right word, but why are we our own greatest challenge?
Well, we've had a unique opportunity. With the fall of the Soviet Union in late 1989 through 1991, we had this generation of essentially being the superpower, the preponderant power in the world. And we did a number of great things, but we also made a number of significant mistakes. Right now, we have a large deficit. We have a tremendous amount of debt where our current debt to GDP level is essentially, you know, our debt is the size of our GDP, which has always been sort of a pivoting point when you look at nations that once their debt rises amount above what they produce in a year, then really the nation is in great difficulty. So we've made a number of spending errors, and I think we've been exhausted by the wars of the last 10 to 15 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we find ourselves sort of upside down and underwater in our mortgage as a nation, so to speak. And we need to begin to address those shortfalls if we're going to put ourselves back on a solid economic, philosophical, you know, and strategic position going into the future.
You write, for the United States to reverse current trends and sustain its position in the world, it will have to examine the extent of its interests and reconnect with the basic cultural fundamentals of grand strategy. Define grand strategy for me, please.
So grand strategy is often looked at as some sort of a balance between means and ends, meaning what are your sources of power, economic, diplomatic, historical, cultural, and what are your strategic ends? Where do you want to go as a nation going forward? And in many ways, over the last generation, we've allowed our strategic vision, our view of where we need to be in the world, has outreached how we've structured the underlying foundation. So we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we did not raise revenues in order to pay for those wars. So essentially for a decade plus, you know, we were essentially doing great and important things in the world, but we were putting it on a credit card. And that is something that, you know, in the past we have not done. And also, we've grown what our role is in the world. We, at one point in time, you know, when prior to the Cold War, we had a very narrowly focused view of ourselves and how we would interact with other nations. During the Cold War, we had merged as the power that had to stand up to communism. And so essentially the world became divided into separate camps. And then following the Cold War, essentially we were the last person standing. And so our role in the world and our view of our role in the world grew. And perhaps grew beyond what we are capable of supporting. And so now we're starting to see sort of a bounce back from that, and we're having to reconsider how we're going to approach the planet and our responsibilities, and how are we going to pay for that.
So a phrase there that you used that I want to explore a little bit, capable of supporting, not necessarily capable of executing, but capable of supporting sounds to me like more of a balance between what are we willing to expend resource-wise, what are we willing to pay for, what are we willing to try to afford, rather than just what would we be able to execute? It sounds like you're arguing that during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, we were able to do all of the things that we wanted to do, but we're just now understanding the kind of hock that we've got into in order to be able to do that. Am I on track?
Yes, you are. And we're sort of dealing right now with a period of overextension. The military forces are exhausted. The Army's readiness is lower than what we're comfortable with. The Navy has been going hard with longer and longer deployments, which has created some deficits in what the readiness of the fleet, the material readiness of the fleet. Some of the ships are in need of repair. The Marine Corps has had extended deployments, the Air Force as well. So we have that in the security relations, but also our economy in many ways is out of balance, and our infrastructure at home is also out of balance. We haven't made significant investments in things like roads, our energy grid, in cyber, and over the past generation. So we haven't essentially kept up the garden and kept the weeds out of it to make sure that we're moving forward as a nation. And I think that we need to take some time to make sure that we get that balance. Also, our relationships with our allies. One of the things that emerged as I began to do the research was that defense spending by our allies has been, you know, gently declining. It was never that high, even during the Cold War. But since the Cold War, they've taken the opportunity to cut back their spending on defense, perhaps even more than we expected. And so now, as we begin to look at strategic issues in Ukraine or in the Middle East, and we begin to look at our allies, we're finding that the allies that we should be there nominally to support are not prepared to carry or uphold their own responsibilities.
You identify some areas of trivia in this. I'm sure you've gotten some interesting responses to your judgments that we may include ISIS as trivia. We may include, you write, bordering on trivia, Russia's operations in Ukraine and interactions with Ukraine. And you also point out the response to Ebola and the United States actions to work there. I'll leave it to other interviewers and other conversations to explain why those are areas of trivia. But you write a section of this paper that I think is the most critical, and that's a segment called A New Mindset. And you argue, you say this is not an argument for isolationism. However, large structural and philosophical questions at home require attention in the near term. What are those questions, and where do you believe we should start to look for the answers?
Well, the partisan divide in the nation has grown deeper and wider over, you know, the period of my professional lifetime. And to the extent that we no longer have even middle ground to meet to decide critical questions that face us as a country. I consider myself to be a creature of the center right, having come out of a Midwestern upbringing as a farmer's son. But even then, I understand that you have to pay the bills as a nation. And you also have to, as I said earlier, you have to keep up the garden. Well, these areas, like, for instance, our roads, our bridges, There's major infrastructure with the rail system that needs reinvestment. Our electrical grid is actually a national security concern. You know, we all recognize that there's a danger of electromagnetic pulse as something that could short out the U.S. electrical system and actually bring the nation down, and it would take a great deal of time to get it back up and operating. And during that time, you know, patients that would be in hospitals would be in danger. And so that system is in dramatic need of refurbishment and upgrading. We need to be burying the grid in many ways. The way that we move information and that information is integrated is something that we have to look at. And I also think that we have to look at cyber and space. These are two new areas that we're using, that we've been the innovators in, but yet we as a people are not sure how to actually manage them in an overarching way. There is no strategic vision. You know, the Congress passes bills on energy and the Congress passes transportation bills, but does the Congress have an omnibus approach to cyber and energy about how we make investments in that? Or do we really just plan to leave that to industry to develop, despite the fact that those have national security implications? Mm-hmm. And so those are some of the things that I think we have to look at to make sure that they're in balance. And quite frankly, I think we have to also look at the military structure, because in many ways it's become out of balance as well. So I think that we have to look at sort of an overall balancing effect on how we bring the ways and means and ends all together back in balance in an affordable way.
This work goes extensively into some of the important considerations that go along with the strategy building that you're thinking about, and that includes cuts to the budget, entitlement reform. You talk about potential tax reform and cite John Locke.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to go directly, though, to the portion on defense cuts on page 26 of this, and we have a link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. This is the week that secretaries of the branches, that Secretary Carter, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and so on, are going to the Hill to make their cases for the budget requests that the administration has made. In the context of what you write in this piece, in this work, I might take away that the arguments that those secretaries and uniformed personnel are making are trivia compared to what we should probably be focused on vis-a-vis a grand strategy. Am I reading? You don't say that.
Yes.
But I wonder if I'm reading between the lines correctly.
Well, even a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and actually while he was in uniform on active duty, Admiral Mike Mullen made the statement that our debt is actually the largest threat to our national security that we face, and that we need to get our debt and our deficit under control if the nation is to remain strong. The reason why I bring up the other things like entitlement reform and revenue enhancements as well as defense is I think that we have to move beyond what has become sort of the sequester argument, which is that discretionary spending has to be the only place where we find fiscal savings going forward. The other two aspects of that, the entitlements make up a vast majority of the U.S. budget and haven't been really been touched and haven't been on the table. And revenues has sort of been that forbidden area where no one can go about bringing taxes, despite the fact that U.S. Tax rates are some of the lowest in the world. And so I think that if we're going to have sort of the grand bargain, then all those have to come onto the table. And I'm uncomfortable with defense being the only source of that, and I don't think that it should continue to be the only source. However, I think that there are additional cuts that can be found in the defense budget. The defense budget today is some 40% larger than what it was on September 10th, 2001. At that point in time, we said that we could fight two major regional conflicts simultaneously. Today, even though we're spending much more and our forces are actually larger, we say that at most we can fight 1.5 regional conflicts simultaneously. Clearly, we've gotten out of whack and we've made some investment decisions that harm us today. For instance, in the Navy shipbuilding budget, which has been about $16 billion on average per year for most of the past decade. We're buying fewer ships within that budget because we made a decision to buy more expensive versions of ships than what we have in the past. For instance, the Ford-class aircraft carrier, there was a CBO report that came out and said that the total cost of the Ford in 2014 dollars was $14 billion. Well, that carrier replaced Nimitz-class carriers, which cost around $6.5 to $7 billion. So we made the decision to buy this platform that costs almost twice as much and yet only gives us a marginal increase in efficiency in aircraft sortie generation by about 30%. Well, it goes from 120 sorties to about 144 sorties a day. We made that decision. And so then when we turn around and say, well, we need additional money for shipbuilding because we have the Ohio-class replacement coming, you know, we're sort of ignoring the fact that the Navy chose to spend that additional money on this new platform for a really marginal return. And we could go down and look at, for instance, the F-22 or the Joint Strike Fighter. You know, great aircraft built for a purpose, but, you know, we could buy three F-16s, which have never been defeated in battle, shot down over 100 enemy aircraft across their life, and have never been defeated once in air-to-air combat, and yet we made this leap ahead to go to fifth-generation fighters. I think there has to be a balance. The argument is that we could continue to draw down within the 2011 BCA, or Budget Control Act, caps, and by making a different investment or a balanced investment between high-end capabilities and low-end capabilities, you know, lower platforms or cheaper platforms that we can purchase in larger numbers, that if we had a balance in our acquisition portfolio, we could actually grow the force and still operate within those BCA caps. So that's the argument that I make there, that we could actually strengthen the force, grow it, while still bringing down the overall defense spending. And again, we really do need to look at growing the force. Quantity does have a quality all of its own. If you want to maintain the global system, economic system of governance in the maritime domain, you need a fleet of about 350 ships. I agree with the Secretary of the Navy and the Navy leadership on that, for instance. And for that matter, we have to grow our air power force in order to patrol the skies. We simply can't do that, though, if we're going to continue to buy more and more expensive platforms. That's a recipe for a declining size of your force. Mm-hmm. There has to be a balance in there somehow.
As you make that case, I think of a term that I hear at just about every hearing, and that is that someone or other says we have the best equipped, best trained military in the history of the world. I don't think anybody debates that. I wonder if the rush to buy the most expensive, biggest bang platform is an interpretation, maybe not a correct interpretation, but an interpretation of that concept of what we must do to provide the best equipped military. It must have the most power, and it must have the most bells and whistles, and it must have the most broadest landscape of capabilities. Is that a reasonable interpretation,
I
you think?
That
maybe not accurate.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that that's sort of the philosophy behind the acquisition strategy. So it's done with the best of intentions. And I also think that there's a residual memory in the modern military that reaches back to the Reagan era when we had a massive buildup of the military sort of across a broad front. And so there's this memory, there's this dream of sort of a return to Reagan-esque defense spending, defense plus-ups, and so on, that we would grow the force and be able to afford to buy the best that's out there. However, the fiscal realities of looking at literally $80 trillion in unfunded mandates going forward into the future as we start looking at Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, the Affordable Care Act costs, you know, point to the fact that the opportunity for that simply isn't there. There's not enough food in the cupboard for us to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to deal with the reality as it exists, which is, I know what my budget is. This is the same question that every American family goes to. We know how much we're going to make this week. So, you know, going out and buying the best of everything is something we simply can't afford. There won't be enough left, you know, for us to survive on. So we have to make a balance between wanting to have that high-end capability for the warfighter, but also, you know, the good enough capability for maintaining the peace. And this is the thing that we think about. You know, 85% of a military platform's life is spent in a peacetime role and environment. You know, providing naval presence is a day-to-day, it's how you maintain the peace to ensure that you never go to war. So do I need the super heterodyned, exquisite platform to maintain the peace? Or quite frankly, can I be satisfied with the good enough? And this is that question of letting the perfect be the enemy of the good enough. If I have a balance that I have a large enough peacetime force for peacetime maintenance, global maintenance, where does that fall in when I have to go to battle? And so I think that that's also a force structure construct where the supporting forces come in. So I think that we have to have sort of a new dialogue within ourselves about how we live within our means and yet meet our security requirements so that, again, we can sustain American preponderance in the world.
The hearkening back to the Reagan era is interesting because you talked about the fiscal realities, and there was a different strategic reality then too, of course. That was, we were essentially trying to run the Soviet Union out of business. Mm-hmm. We don't have an opponent on the strategic landscape today that we're expecting to run out of business anytime soon.
No, and in fact, earlier in the paper, I take on sort of where we might see a competitor emerge from. So I looked at Europe, which is still too fractured to come together, to have the sort of economy of scale to be able to compete with the United States. Russia, you know, has relatively a very small defense budget, even though it's making a lot of noise right now. Russia itself has a lot of issues demographically. It's got a declining life expectancy. It has increasing alcoholism, a declining birth rate. Russia is not going to emerge as a major world power I think, within a generation. And even if we look at China, China's also got sort of an upside down and underwater, you know, issue coming with its demographics, as its one child policy is going to generate essentially, you know, that one child soon will have to pay the equivalent of Social Security for two parents and four grandparents. And so if we look at their demographics as how they're aging, China's faced with sort of a 10-year window right now where they need to get great before they get old.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, beyond the, sort of that 2025 time frame, China's going to be absorbed internally with dealing with a rapidly aging population. Right now China has a lot to catch up with us, would like to be able to establish sort of a sphere of influence in the Western Pacific. Our job right now is essentially to deny them that opportunity by remaining forward present. As long as we're there, they're not going to be able to establish that new status quo amongst the other partners in the region.
So to that end, I've heard you make this argument before, but particularly about your service of experience, the Navy, you write, the Navy could set a new course that balances low-end influence operations, where the Navy already spends most of its time with a high-end power projection. And you write, by taking such a path, the Navy could actually increase the size of the fleet to over 330 self-deployable ships in as little as 7 years. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me like that is the path that you're suggesting, as you discussed earlier, being more judicious about what you buy. We're certainly not going to boost up to 330 carriers, but it's the right mix of ships in the fleet and not just the number that's important, it sounds like.
So, there's a couple ways through this. Currently, we buy two Arleigh Burke-class Aegis destroyers per year in the budget. Sometimes we get 2.5, depending on how it comes in the funding line. And each one of those costs between $2 to $2.4 billion a piece. If we were to only build one, for instance, right now we have some 60 Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, and although we call them destroyers, they're sort of the historical equivalent of battleships. If you really look at how well they're armed with their 96 vertical launch tubes that are filled with Tomahawks and Standard missiles and so on, these are really state-of-the-art battleships in the modern era and are respected as such around the world. So we have 62 of those. At the height of the battleship building craze, we got up to about 40. So if we only built one per year, for the next 7 years, and I rededicate the money spent on the second one to I could buy additional frigates, as we're now calling the littoral combat ships. We're now calling those frigates. I could buy frigates. I could buy joint high-speed vessels, which is an intra-theater lift platform that I can roll weapon systems and sensors on and off. The frigate costs about $500 million. The JHSV, or the joint high-speed vessel, that costs about $140 million. And so I could be plussing up the size of my deployable presence-required fleet quite dramatically, shifting resources within that. And then, of course, in my most controversial suggestion, that if we cease building supercarriers because they become too expensive and too vulnerable in an anti-access air-denied environment, that would free some $14 billion. Of course, we purchased those over a five-year period, so it works out to about $3.5 billion per year that we could rededicate. Mm-hmm. And mind you, we have a very major bill coming up with how are we going to pay for the Ohio-class replacement. The Ohio-class is our ballistic missile nuclear deterrent force, and we need to buy 12 of those coming up. And right now, we don't have enough money in the shipbuilding budget to do that and continue to buy the other things. So I think we face some hard choices, but if we make the right ones, we can actually, again, grow the force rather rapidly.
You agree with the Pentagon in one area here in particular. You write, you title a segment of this chapter, page 29, The Critical Component, Research and Development. The criticism of the Pentagon's current approach to R&D is primarily from industry, and that is they want us, they being the Pentagon, us being industry, they want us to do all the research, assume all the risk with no guarantee of profit. How do we straighten that line in some way where the risk is spread evenly? Maybe there's not – I don't know what that looks like, but how do we kind of win – I guess win industry back that the Pentagon's intentions on R&D don't involve pushing all the risk off on the defense industrial base?
Well, there's two things here. First of all, industry is not the only source of R&D. The military has a laboratory system. It has its own internal science and research, and we could actually make investments in areas like DARPA or in the Office of Naval Research where we can home grow some of our own innovation going forward so that it's not that we're not so dependent just solely on industry. The other thing that I would point out is that industry and its current fixation with profit and dividends. Now, I'm a capitalist. I believe in profit. And not to mention, I'm an investor in the stock market, so I like dividends. But right now, the focus on maintaining the dividends to the shareholders has taken a new importance in the current generation of business managers. In the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, if you look at the defense infrastructure at that time, and you look at both profit motive as well as the dividend structure, as vis-a-vis how much they're investing in R&D, it's completely different from the way that we look at it. So this is a recent part of the way that the stock market system looks at a defense industry. So I think that we were right to ask the question as to industry and where it's investing and to the degree, that it wants to pass those expenses off, onto the government. Industry's there for risk. And stockholders are there for risk as well. So there's a requirement for innovation there that we would hope that we would encourage. That being said, there are a number of areas that we all know about, directed energy, hypersonics, stealth, of course. We're still continuing to mature stealth. We ought to see increased investment at that. But what I'm really interested in is the thing that no one's talking about. In the 1930s, when the Manhattan Project gets off the ground, there's only about 16 people in the country that even have an awareness of the implications of that. And I'm interested in that scientist that's sitting out at the, Purdue University in a science lab or an engineering lab who's happened upon something. And so I think that there's also something to be said for the research universities that are out there that where the government can spend in our vast university system to see what new ideas and innovation are there. So again, so the government is not totally dependent on industry to drive innovation or our own improvements. You know, the U.S. invests a lot in our education system. Let's see what return we can have on that.
Do you think the network that would be have to exist to get those ideas to the attention of the right people in the Pentagon is a healthy one right now, Jerry?
No. It's ahistorical right now. In the past, the amount of interaction between industry and innovators in industry, or for that matter, industry and the operational fleets, be that the air fleet or the surface fleet or the naval fleet or even the Army, we're not seeing that type of interaction. We have built up so many layers of rules about how the military can interact with industry. You know, chiefs of staff cannot be in the room with industry leaders without a lawyer being beside their by their side to make sure they're not violating some rule. And so the conversation has really gotten stilted, which is one of the reasons why I enjoy now that I've retired from active duty, to be in a think tank environment where we can actually host events between active duty military leaders or civilian political leaders and then leaders of industry in informal settings where there can be really an open and robust conversation. But I think back about the 1920s and 1930s, the interwar period, which was a rapid era of innovation, and the types of conversations that are going on between industry and the military as we're really adapting aircraft while they're being built or adapting ships while they're being built, and we're building really small batches of destroyers and airplanes before we move on to the next iteration. So we're seeing continuous improvement. Today, if we look at the cost associated with fielding a platform like the Joint Strike Fighter, which has been in development for literally decades and now is just getting to the point where we're operationally fielding, you know, it's cost prohibitive to innovate in many ways.
Are you as concerned as the Pentagon is about another round of consolidation in the defense industrial base?
I am concerned about defense infrastructure. Right now, shipbuilding is down as about as small as what I would be comfortable with in order to ensure that we have competition. And as we look at the coming competition on the long-range strategic bomber project, where essentially we only have three major military aviation producers in this country, between Boeing and Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman. Depending on how that goes, you know, we could find ourselves in a place where one of those goes away. So Joint Strike Fighter is still in production. Boeing is still building the F/A-18 Hornet, which is a really great aircraft. And Northrop Grumman has been competing really strongly in unmanned systems. And really, you know, when we go in that long-range strategic bomber, that could have real significant implications. And I think the nation would find itself in an uncomfortable place if we got to somewhere where there was only two producers. Mm-hmm. Competition, innovation, the ideas sort of leave the marketplace when you get that. So I do have a lot of concern about maintaining something like the aviation industrial base.
What are the political implications of trying to get where you're suggesting we should go in this piece, Jerry?
The political implications is that we're going to have to get serious and make some difficult, uncomfortable, and unpopular decisions, something that, quite frankly, has gone out of style and fashion. We're going to have to make decisions about revenues, which is something that, you know, half the Congress doesn't want to talk about, is revenue enhancements or how do we get more money into the system. We're going to have to talk about looking at entitlements, which is another half of the Congress doesn't ever want to talk about touching entitlements. And yet, if we're going to eliminate this $500 to $700 billion a year in deficits, those are two areas that we're going to have to go. And then we're going to have to continue to look at efficiencies and economies of scale within the government on how we get some costs out of that and bring down the cost of government in people's lives. And so, you know, all of these things are politically difficult to discuss. There has to be a high degree of trust. We have to grow back the bipartisan consensus on national security and foreign policy. This is one of the things that, as a historian, that I spend a lot of time looking at, is how did we create that era of bipartisan consensus around the containment strategy beginning in the late 1940s into the 1950s, where essentially it didn't matter which side of the aisle you were on. You understood that this was U.S. national security policy, and you supported it going forward, a consensus that lasted through the end of the Cold War. Today we live in a different environment. Today we live in an environment where, as I said earlier, you know, we are a threat to ourselves. How do we rebuild that consensus so that we can address that threat and get on the right step going into the future?
One of the notes that I make as I think about where we were in the 40s and 50s compared to today is technology has allowed the people on either side of the spectrum, at the very edges of the spectrum, a louder pulpit, a louder way of getting their voice heard than we ever had back then. I think about some of the people who were on the fringes throughout those debates, and you never really heard about them. And today, that's not the case.
Yeah, the loss of the vital center of moderates who will work with both sides of the aisle, you know, that's a notable absence. One of the things that I do hope, though, is a lot of that bipartisan consensus that we saw in the 50s and the 60s came out of the World War II generation, that whether it was Jack Kennedy or Dick Nixon, that they could meet in the middle because of that shared experience of the war. And today we have a new generation of congressmen and senators who have come in that have grown up in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and are now have raised their right hand to, you know, uphold and protect the Constitution in the elected legislature. And so the idea that perhaps we can get them to find common ground to begin building some sort of a consensus around defense, national security, is one of my hopes. At least they should be mature enough, having seen the realities of war, to understand the importance of working together as a team now, regardless of whether there's an R or a D after their name.